Hey, everybody, and welcome to this edition of the Linux Link Tech Show. This is episode 74. Wow, that's a lot. On this fine,
almost to 100.
That's right. On this fine and frosty March 9th of 2005. And boy, do we have
beyond frosty.
That's today. Right. Yeah, it's wicked cold out there. We have an awesome show coming on for you tonight with our buddy, our pal, Doc Searles, who will be joining us later. Yeah. And, of course, our other wonderful talk and techie goodness. But first, word from Dan Compiling. Make sure you give a listen to this.
Now, class, what did we learn about today?
Tech Show!
And what do we do with the Tech Show, children?
Listen, damn it.
And who's your favorite Tech Show host?
Nick.
Very good, class.
That's right, children. Tune in every Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and get your Linux education on the Linux Link Tech Show.
Are you tired of when iPodder crashes or misses a podcast? Is iPodder X not powerful enough? Are you tired of the software not doing what you want it to do? Do you need a podcatcher that works on multiple platforms such as Linux, Mac OS X, AIX, and even Windows? Then try BashPodder. BashPodder does what you want it to do and when you want it. BashPodder. It just works.
And that's it. That's what I think anyway. BashPodder. It just works. I might be,
Oh, wait. That's
slightly biased?
I might be slightly biased. But speaking of which, did you guys check out that I actually...
I saw your page.
Yeah, on Dan's suggestion, I put an actual web page up for BashPodder.
Could you hand me a printout from over there? Or is it just like mashing him back inside into the camcorder and rolling around and refusing itself and, and causing a fire?
Is that printout that's printing out there, or that camcorder that's like the under desk cam, so you can
That's my lap cam.
Watch yourself naked
nice
while you're
shot
sitting out there.
No, it's not pointing at me tonight.
You don't think it's pointing at you, but I turned it all around.
All right.
So of course, like the big news today. Is that, we walk in here, and Dan is once again
compiling
kernels.
Back to the old
ways. You know what? I don't understand. It just confuses the heck out of me. Why do I sound so muffled in here? Maybe.
turn up your volume. Yeah.
I don't understand. Why in the... I had a hard drive failure last night.
A NAD cam.
A big time hard drive failure.
Sooner or later, you learn not to touch your systems.
The hard drive just blew up. I noticed it was happening for a little while, DMA errors, but it just totally fried, cooked. That's it. I have to send it back to MaxTor. It is a defective drive. I found out through their utilities. Anyway, I never did any backups, of course, since the last time. So, the only thing I lost was the software I downloaded and compiled myself.
Do your backups.
Yeah, well, I am going to do that now. Wonder with CD. Because I got a new drive coming, so I'm going to have to wipe this out and do it again. But anyway.
And get all the porn off of it.
Yeah. That's all gone now.
It's gone now. He wiped his drive.
I thought about putting a web collage back on it because I wanted to see if it would start pulling out porn sites again. But, well, anyway, that said, the wife said, when are you going to hook my computer up to the printer again? Because I need to print. I was like, all right, we'll do it. I come up here and I go to do the printer. Apps filter's no longer in Slackware because I did a fresh install of 10.1.
Ooh, bad.
They moved it
move.
To the pasture. And I never thought to, you know, to install stuff off the pasture yet.
That is
so
a
that's
bad
cool.
move.
So I didn't realize it was in the pasture until I looked on the change log. So I had to go with, I looked in the packages text file and it wasn't listed in there. So I had to go with cups. You know, I threw cups on there. But the damn thing about it was it wouldn't find or initialize my parallel port or my parallel port device. So I had no LP0. So I had no way to print to my parallel port. And I was mod probing in parallel paraport and paraport PC, but I forgot the LP0.
Yes.
And I uncommented the stuff in the rc.modules file. I couldn't figure out why it wasn't doing this. Well, long story short, after a long kernel compile and still nothing working, Link said, why don't you mod probe that in? We did it. Yep.
Link saves
but
the day.
But why? Why is that disabled? That should not be disabled. That's ridiculous.
Link, just so you did, let's recap this. Link saves the day once again, right? This is the history and the story of my life. Why don't you just mod probe LP? Oh, hey, look at that.
Gosh.
It works. However, I'm still, like, wickedly disappointed. One, I don't like you, Dev, right? It could be just that, like, that I'm not comfortable with it. But, you know, the regular dev file system has been working. What the hell's the problem with that, you know? Why fix something that ain't broke? That's what I want to know. And then cups. Like, cups and I have never, ever gotten along. The only time, and like, literally, like, there's... The only two distributions I've ever gotten cups to work on right is Ubuntu and the hell is the other one?
Mopic?
Yellow Dog.
No.
Yellow Dog. And the reason, I think the reason that I actually got them to work is because I wasn't trying to hit a local printer, I was hitting a network printer. That could be the thing. Like, the local printer was actually attached to a Slackware box and being shared via that Slackware box. So perhaps that was, you know, I don't know. At any rate,
Go Gadget.
We have,
go.
Of course, Dan here tonight compiling his kernel. And boy, you sure heard the bitch in his butter. And we have Alan. Hey, Alan.
Hello.
And Pat is here, too.
Good evening.
Good evening. And boy, that's about it, isn't it? No, just kidding. We have all kinds of stuff going on tonight.
You know what you were talking about? They did all this crap. Now you're thinking about maybe going Ubuntu. And the problem is, I thought about that too, but it's hard to find a distribution where you get enough packages for a really functional system.
Right.
That doesn't depend on a...
Full-featured.
Featured system that doesn't depend on... A packaging system that's anal about dependencies, where you can compile your own software and still, you know, use other packages and not have these, like, the RPM hell that you go through, and it won't let you install an RPM.
Yeah.
Because you don't have a specific dependency unless you force it, and then you get all sorts of wacky things going on. And then, you know, like, app gets great, but it'll automatically grab those dependencies for you because it doesn't think you have them, and now you got something different than what you installed on your system. Why? Where is the magic?
I don't know. See, but here's the thing. Like, I really like Slackware. Slackware is my desktop system. It's been that way for a long, long time.
Oh, yours, huh?
Yeah, mine.
Yours
personally, it was made for me. Not that I don't like Ubuntu. I think Ubuntu is a wonderful desktop system. I also think Yellow Dog is a good desktop system. However, they have their, you know, they have their little drawbacks. And like Dan was saying, Ubuntu isn't anywhere near as full featured as a basic Slackware install, and Yellow Dog is kind of, however, it's limited because it has like it doesn't have a very full PPC support yet.
Yeah, it's not all there.
However, I think that envelope is going to change very soon because speaking of PPC Linux, you know, Ubuntu has. Supposedly, like, I haven't run it on PPC yet, but Dan runs it all the time. Has wonderful PPC support, right, Dan?
Yeah, great.
Dan's off in the ozone. So Ubuntu has PPC support. Gentoo has PPC support. Mandrake does. SUSE does, although I don't think they're quite as up-to-date as Ubuntu is. And the big announcement that I saw today was that who was Linus Torvalds actually has switched his main desktop machine to a
G5.
Yeah, a dual proc G5. So
running Linux, of course.
Yeah, and he said it was, you know, it was high time that that some work was done on the Linux on the PPC architecture. And hey, I'm all for that, because PPC architecture, if you look, is indeed better than
Get the damn sound working properly so you can record something.
What are we doing here? We got call-ins already or something?
No.
Does your sound card work under PPC? I mean, recording on your...
On my blue and white?
On any of them?
No.
No. I can't record on here either. Sometimes playing back audio is just...
You know what you got to do, though?
Crap.
After if we take a break or something, we'll have to try this out, because I know... That Pat brought over his Logitech headset. Is it Logitech?
Yeah.
His Logitech USB headset. So we got to stick that on Ubuntu PPC and see if you can record on that, and it works really good. If it does, like, that's the answer, man.
Yeah, but I don't want to just record that. I want to record other sources.
Yeah, but if the... You're not catching me.
Well, I'd have to get a USB...
You get a USB audio...
Audio
dongle for it, and that'd do it. Like, I haven't tried that either yet, but maybe that's... You know, maybe
and flash support final would be nice for PPC.
Yeah, but
and
I think that's
current builds of software.
I think that's going to take some bitching. Current builds of software, you know, we could do if we just had enough. If we had more people running PPC, there would be more current builds of software.
There would be more current build. And you know what? Before we get on, to
I mean,
Doc,
we have Dan. And Dan is the compile king, so why isn't everything
Why aren't you
current?
Compiling stuff?
Did you ever try and compile Mozilla? Holy moly. There's a reason why you don't want to compile Mozilla.
Did Gentoo install? That took about 3 days.
There's a reason.
Gorkon, Sadie, Griffin, I might.
You know what? I don't want to bust on the Gentoo people, because, you know, they there's a difference between compiling and Gentoo compiling. Gentoo, they have gone that extra step of making a build script for you. It's not that you go down there and do configure, make, and that. But, you know, and I'm not busting on Gentoo. Gentoo, they do a fantastic job. The other thing that you have, you
until
know...
Until they try and edit the SE.
But the pro, you know, but you know, the flip side of that is you really got to know how to set your configure parameters or whatever the heck they're called on Gentoo. But anyway... still, there's a little bit of difference, because there's some really... and I've gone to build scripts on Debian's build scripts to see what options I should throw in there for some applications that I'm having a problem compiling. But it is slightly different. Why are we talking about Gentoo?
I don't know.
Oh, Pat brought up Gentoo about compiling Mozilla.
Talking about compiling for days.
Compiling Mozilla. Yeah, you need like 100... megs of disk space or something, at least. That's probably even more than that. Get like a gig of space takes up when it compiles it, and then you install it. And oh, I've done it a few times. It's not a fun thing to do.
Hey, I remember doing that. I remember working a week trying to get X running on a Gentoo PPC system, and after the week compiled, it still didn't work.
X.
No, that wasn't KDE. That was just X, man. It was just trying to get the X server going. That was
I wouldn't do a Gentoo install again unless I had at least a 2 gigahertz machine.
Not to put the Gentoo people down like Dan say, but I wouldn't do another Gentoo install.
But you know what I wanted to get at?
I've never done
with
one.
Regards to this?
It's an experience.
Is, Patrick was sending me his Myth TV presentations this week, and I couldn't open them. And he did him in Open Office
2 beta.
And when my machine died, I went over there because I figured, well, I got to grab Open Office. And, you know, on their site now, it's big. 2 beta is out.
Mm-hmm.
And I grabbed the 2 beta. Had no problem at all installing it in Slackware using RPM to TGZ to convert them into Slackware packages, and then did, just standard install package. And it worked great. And I didn't really get a chance to play around too much with OpenOffice 2.0 beta. Is it working great for you?
I haven't had any problems with it so far.
But what is nice, though, what else I noticed is, what is it, NeoOffice is out. And that is the native Carbon / Java open office version for OS X that you don't have use the X11. And that is really nice because when I, you know, when people at work want to use open office on, if they, we try to put them on the PowerBooks, you have to install the developmenter tools and run the X server. And they're like, ah, this isn't really for people, you know, who aren't, don't know what they're doing.
But you don't have to do that if you just install Linux on the PPC, right?
Well, no, you don't, but then you have a whole different thing. Anyway, NeoOffice runs great. I was really impressed. I used it to make a document today, a little tutorial for people to follow on my training session. But props to OpenOffice, you know, for that. It's really, 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 really great.
Free to use, free exploring. To download.
It's definitely faster than the old version.
Yeah, it is. And it's great.
Was it OpenOffice 2.0?
Yeah, 2.0 beta.
Starts right up quick?
Pretty quick. That's pretty good. Do you want me to open it up over there for you?
Dude, you got a brand new 2-point-something million gigahertz machine over there. It ought to start right the frick up for you over there.
Do you want to see how fast it starts up?
Yeah, start it up.
Wait, I got to get
the roll. Watch ready.
Here we go. It's got, what, a gig of RAM?
That's how many seconds it takes.
Do you have a gig of RAM or just 512?
Oh, wait. 512.
Oh, wait, he's forgotten where it's stored.
Yeah, I forgot where it is. That's right, it's no longer in that same location. Here we go.
Ooh, it's like 5
Holy
seconds.
Mackerel!
Fast.
5 seconds for 2.0 on a 2.4 gigahertz machine, right?
2.2.
2.2 gigahertz.
Wait, I don't know. It's an AMD 2700, which means it's a 2.2.
2-point-something gigahertz machine with 512 mega RAM.
It
appears that it started pretty much right up. However, you know, my old OpenOffice on my 2.4 gigahertz machine works, starts about that fast too. So the trick is,
of course, this has turned into we need the video channel now. You know,
right? So everybody can. We need that whiteboard, that whiteboard thing going on application. Everybody can see what the hell we're doing. What I should do is like download the 2.0 and stick it on my Slack 10 box. My laptop, which runs at 400 megahertz, and
see how fast it'll
open up then. That
Dan's
actually may be
a nice
the
presentation.
Test.
Yeah,
that may be the test. All right. So what else is going on?
Still need
on?
A main title there, Dan.
But he's not like he's not happy with compiling a kernel during the show. Now he's going to write a presentation too.
Yeah, that's it. You ever see the tub girl picture?
No.
Is that the one with the stream sound?
No, I don't think I want it.
If you saw the tub girl picture, you wouldn't be asking, is that the one with that?
No,
you know exactly what it is.
I'll pass on that one.
You've seen Goatsy, right?
Oh, yeah.
I think everybody's seen Goatsy inadvertently at least once.
Yeah, inadvertently. There you go. It's one of those ones you roll by and you go, wah!
Yeah. Everybody who's ever been the slashed out has been hit with that one at least once.
And then you remember what that is, and anytime someone mentions it again, you avoid it like the plague.
What? What are we talking about?
Goatsy. Except for Dan, who uses it as like a screen saver or something. You know?
Yeah, it's always great to introduce somebody new to Goatsy.
What a freak.
Did you ever see the prime number generator, Goatsy? There's a lot of good, great Goatsy stuff. Maybe we should give Doc a call before we get too far off topic. Then we come back with the Dooley Eye Rivers.
That's right. Yes. We're supposed to talk to Doc now, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that like some sort of like cartoon? You know, it's like we put the Wonder Twin powers there, you and Link with the Eye Rivers.
Eye
River powers, unite!
Activate!
You know what would be nice, though? Of course, it wouldn't be great if this was a little bigger, but if it was a little bigger, it would look just like a lightsaber handle, wouldn't it? And you could go to the opening of...
we're playing with our Eye Rivers,
Revenge of
the
Sith, like this. And just get like a big plastic piece
to hang
up.
You've got the digital camera now. Take pictures of that and like rotoscope it in for you. You can have the iPod lightsaber.
rotoscoped Eye River lightsabers.
And I was playing with Keenan last night.
Trying to do some digital video editing.
That's called Doc. All right, let's get a hold of Doc. Pat's having a thing over here, man. He's either, you know, I don't know whether it's like he's got to go to the bathroom. He's just rubbing his leg.
Oh, I should have checked
his leg furiously. Or is that Alan's leg he's rubbing?
No, I'm just giving him the mic. Yeah.
Yeah, you're giving him the mic. All right.
Hello?
I was going to say, let me plug in the headset.
Oh, wow, that's some good quality.
Definitely good.
There we go.
Yeah.
I better check.
Hey,
Doc. I didn't check my mixer settings before I did this.
We're good.
How's it going, Doc?
It's going well. It's going well. How do I sound?
Sounds excellent.
Sound fantastic.
That's good. I guess the
little built-in
mic, I guess, is doing the job.
Well, what are you using? What do you want, an Apple? Or?
In this case, yeah. I also have a ThinkPad running SUSE over here. But the fan is pretty loud, so that's why I was opting for this. Although, with that one, I can use an external microphone. With this one, I haven't figured it out yet. So it's kind of a... But I've done it. I've done... podcasts. I mean, I've done interviews before on this one, so I thought, okay, we'll use this one.
Sounds good.
Awesome. Now, this is officially a Linux kind of show now, because not only have we had Marcel Gagne on here, now we've had Doc Searles. You just can't beat that. This is it. We're good now.
Cool. Well, glad to help.
Hey, anytime you want to come on, you're welcome to come on. I understand that you're not doing a whole lot of shows with the Linux show anymore. How are things going with that?
I don't know. I mean, Jeff Gerhardt, who labored mightily for many, many years on that and did a really good job of producing it with the other guys there, kind of took it on hiatus, I guess, back around... Well, late last year, somewhere in there. And he's talked about bringing it back, but I'm not sure what the deal is. I hope he does, because he sort of punched out right at the point when podcasting was getting big. So, I think the key is doing both, having a live broadcast and having a podcast if you can do it. So.
Sure, which is what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It helps the distribution model out quite a bit. I also saw, speaking of that show, when I was over there rummaging around some of the websites, I saw, and I can't find it now for the life of me, I saw there was another show that you all were going to do, or was it the Linux show? Was called the Open Sourcers Open Show or something like that? Am I going crazy?
That doesn't sound
funny. I could have sworn I saw
it. I mean, I've been involved in something called the Gilmore Gang. Which is on IT Conversations.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been going. That's pretty good. We like that a lot.
Yeah, it's a good show. It's also on a kind of hiatus right now while Steve Gilmore works something out. But I don't know. You know, I'm sort of leaving it all up to Steve. I intend to do some podcasting on involving Linux Journal, probably with IT Garage, which is this sister site that I run.
Right.
So that's the idea. That's an idea, I should say.
You're going to do that by yourself or with other people?
Oh, I'm sure I'll end up doing it with other people. At the very least, I'll have other people on it. I have a really big pile of interviews that I've done over the years that I'd love to convert to, editable form, you know, and then turn into a bunch of MP3s or a bunch of shows. I'm not sure. One thing. There are a lot of people I'd love to talk to as well and see what I can make happen. But, part of it is just that I just need to get my own little act together here, figure out what tools I need. You know, I'm an old radio guy, so I'm kind of a perfectionist. I want good sound. I want good production values. I want to be able to know the technology. I really want to be able to have dialogue going with other people. You know, in other words, if Adam Curry on his Daily Source goes to something interesting that I'm listening to on a portable device, I want to be able to respond to that and annotate it and, you know, have a kind of online dialogue going with it. I think that's a much more fun way to do the future of talk radio than, you know, anything we've seen so far. You know, I really like the portability of what you can do with a little device and storing and forwarding and kind of using the laptop or the office machine as a way to produce it. I can't believe it. I'm very silenced.
Hello?
I have a funny a Sony Ericsson phone. I was at a party a few weeks ago in New York City when one of these, which has a, you know, you, out of the zillion ringtones, right, there's one that's like an old Western Electric phone.
Mm-hmm.
And one of these things rang, and everybody reached for their pockets. It turned out everybody had that same ringtone. And, of course, they were all, they were mostly guys from my generation, right, you know, who remember that fondly. It's one of those lost sounds, you know.
Remember when phones weighed 20 pounds.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. You can commit crimes with it. It's heavy enough to do that way.
That's kind of like a tradition, though. Every time we do an interview with somebody, their phone's ringing in the background or something like that.
We're lucky right. My phone's not
Yeah,
ringing.
Hell, it happens here at every other show. Dan's phone rings in the background.
Phone's ringing, kids are screaming.
Dog's barking.
Are we on the air, so to speak, now? Or
absolutely.
Oh, good.
You are virtually live, almost sort of, kind of.
Almost live, as Adam says. Bumper promos, like to say.
Yep, our show is streamed live as we do it, and then we repeat it all week long, and we also podcast it. So it goes all, and we provide archives for people to download. So it goes all over the place, and boy, you'll be almost a famous guy by tomorrow.
Yeah, like, there's
I never knew who Doc was until he came on the Linux show.
I know. David Weinberger, who I co-wrote the Clue Train Manifesto with, says in the future everybody will be famous for 15 people.
Sure.
And, that's sort of what we achieve with this, I think. You know, try to get it up to 15 for everybody.
Well, it's as long as I make the 15 list for you, Doc, I'm happy. So
that's great.
You know what? Why do we have 11 listeners on our stream?
I don't know.
They should be over on BinRev.
Everybody go to BinRev.
Yeah, everybody go to BinRev stream.
I don't want Doc to get chopped out.
Yeah.
So Doc, the question I want to ask is, what do you think all this podcasting is going? I know you guys had the conversation of, you know, possible business models with podcasting, where the revenue is going to come from. What do you think it's going?
Well, I think it's, well, first of all, it really is early. It's interesting to me that I wrote a piece on podcasting in IT Garage back in September, and I counted 29 results or 24 results from a Google search of podcasts, I think it was. And I just looked again, and there were like 778,000 results. But even that said, I think it's still pretty small. I think it's still... I like where it is right now. I like how wide open it is. I like how easily it could morph into one thing or another thing. I like the amateur quality of it. And I remember over-the-air radio when it was still pretty experimental. I mean, I'm 57 years old. I was born in the first half of the last century, which is a scary thought to me. But I grew up at a time when rock and roll was new, and it was mostly what you heard on these little, on lesser stations on the AM dial. I mean, that's long before FM was big at all. Everything was AM, and there weren't that many stations at that. There were big ones and there were small ones, and all the big ones were playing the Farm and Home Hour and really boring stuff with, daily features that had been there forever. And these little stations were looking for anything that could help them succeed. And there was just some really, you know, it was some pretty cool stuff. And then along came transistor radios. And in many ways, iPods and MP3 players are the transistor radios of today. The difference is that there's so many more participants in the whole thing. I mean, this is an infinite number of potential participants. And so it's really hard to say where it's going. You could look at radio back then and say, well, you know, these little stations, even the biggest ones, go maybe 100 miles, and maybe they skip off the ionosphere at night, and that's kind of cool, but now you've got anybody can do anything, and I'm sure the most interesting stuff that's going to be done in podcasting a year from now is stuff that we're not anticipating at all. You know, I mean, maybe it's comedy, maybe it's some personality, maybe it's You know, somebody comes along with some way to, you know, to harness micropayments. Maybe it happens over cell phones. Maybe micropayments and cell phones come together, which I think would be a really good thing to have happen at some point. I think that in just to take one of those topics, that two topics really. I think music is going to be big. Tim Bray wrote something about that. Tim Bray is one of the prime movers behind XML, and he's got a weblog, and he said in the last couple of days that he still thinks that music is going to be it. I think it's going to be. I think the first kind of music we're going to see being a hit on the net is exactly the kind of stuff that the RIAA forced to be a hit because of the unintended consequences law. I mean, are you guys familiar with how the RIAA basically shut down music broadcasting on the net like 2 years ago or 3 years ago?
Yes. Somewhat, but you know what? Some of our listeners might not be. Go ahead and refresh.
It was interesting. I wrote about it a lot in Linux Journal at the time it was going down. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act of 1998 was basically lobbied through Congress by the record industry actually the whole entertainment industry, but on the radio side by the record industry. And it left open some way, you know, to negotiate how copyright and royalties would be settled between webcasters, because they didn't imagine podcasting back then. They only imagined webcasting, live webcasting, and the record industry. And then what they wanted to do is plug what they later called the analog hole. They wanted to force on internet broadcasting what they missed forcing on over-the-air broadcasting, where the law only supports royalties for composers but not for distributors and producers and for that matter artists. And so they essentially decided to impose a regulatory regime on webcasting that was so difficult, so heinous, so hard to do, that some really good radio stations like KPIG in Freedom, California, a perfect name for a town and for a station like that, which had been
that was a great station when he
it was a great station. It was the first regular over the air radio station to broadcast, the first commercial station to broadcast on the net, and they failed to make it through a loophole that that Jesse Helms at the last minute got inserted into the settlement between that was forced between the webcasters and the record industry, and Helms did it basically, I think, to protect the Christian broadcasters. I think those were his buddies, and they, who have always been very resourceful, saw, you know, some way to come up with some sort of settlement. But essentially, it strangled the industry in its cradle way back then. I mean, it pretty much didn't so much squeeze it totally out of it, but just throttled it way back. And there's a huge energy at it. Well, in the same way, Napster and FileShare songs kind of users work on failures of commercial radio. We're seeing podcasting as the user workaround of the failures of radio again, essentially, and of the music industry. And so there's this whole concept of pod-safe music. Have you followed pod-safe music at all?
Slightly.
Yeah, well, pod-safe music is not RIAA music. It's music that's licensed by a Creative Commons license, for example. It's a runaround.
That's what we normally play when we play music on the show, Creative Commons license.
Yeah, so that's called pod-safe music. And I think that at some point there's going to be a hit that, or a number of hits that are going to be pod-safe songs, and they'll illustrate how completely. And you said, like, right now we're using Skype. I mean, Skype, although it's kind of a closed and proprietary system, is a really cool workaround of the failure of the phone industry to give us voice over IP. Well, a similar thing's going to happen, I think, with music. There's going to be some hit, and it's going to be cool. That's one thing. I think the other thing is just going to be, just talent. You know, there's going to be talent out there that we haven't seen yet that's going to do fun stuff.
I tell you what, broadcast radio, I think, is quaking in its boots right now. They're scared of satellite radio, and they're scared of podcasts, to be quite frank.
I think they are, too, and I think that... but I know some people in those businesses, and I know everything I'm hearing is that on the one hand, they're scared, and on the other hand, they really want to do something. So now, they, of course, is some subset of the total. An awful lot of talent got driven out of the radio business over the last 20 or 30 years. As has been consolidated, but I think it's inevitable. And I think they're going to look at it, too, as a cheap way to get content, as they say. I always hated the term content, but I think that's... They're going to look at podcasts and say, wait a minute, there are umpty zillion of these out there. Let's look through them for stuff that's cool, and let's put some of this on. It's going to happen sooner or later.
There's definitely talent out there that, most people don't know about. There's going to be some kid, some in the middle of nowhere who does his own podcast, and he's going to be really good, and people are going to notice, I think.
Right. I agree.
So, what sort of reprisals do you think we can expect to see in the near future from organizations such as the Ever Evil RIAA when they start figuring out that this podcasting stuff and sharing files, copy protected music or Creative Commons music over the net is starting to cut into their bottom line?
I don't know. I think that if they're smart, they're going to see that they failed to cork a genie in the bottle with the CARP ruling from several years ago. I think that they're not entirely evil and stupid. I think they're just protecting. Larry Lessig gave a really good speech at the open source convention several years ago, and he talked about how it's just standard. The old systems want to protect itself. It's no different with this than it's anything else. It's just what they do. And at a certain point, they cave in. At a certain point, they realize that they're being taken over. But I actually think it's going to be a little bit. I think it's going to happen actually inside the record. Some of the record houses themselves. You're going to have record executives whose kids are making pod-safe music. One of the interesting things to me with Linux and covering Linux over the last, it's almost a decade now, to me is that, every time I saw a company say that we're now standardizing on Linux, we're now a Linux company, like IBM did, for example, or HP, saying, that it's a strategic decision to start selling stuff based on Linux. Well, in every one of those cases, what they did was get an alignment with their own engineers. Because
right.
what happens in companies like that is that you may have top-down IT policy that says you're going to have nothing but Microsoft here, or you're going to have AIX, or you're going to have HPUX, or some other thing like that. And the rank-and-file IT guys are going and putting up Samba servers, and they're putting up web servers running Apache on Linux, and then they're going to start moving over some databases to MySQL and to Postgres and so forth.
Gee, I know somebody who does that.
Well, the thing is, we all know thousands of people who do this.
Yeah.
I mean, what happened at I know what happened at IBM. I mean, and it's because in fact, on the Linux show, we talked to some people who at IBM who did that. They went from looking at Linux as something they could stick under a WebSphere server into something that their own workers were doing cool things
at some point in time, it just starts to make economic sense to them. And, you know, that's really what changes people's minds anyway.
Well, I tell you, one of the things that's going to make a difference is the... any of you guys see the Chris Anderson's piece on the long tail in Wired? It was kind of a well-linked piece from, I think it was November of last year.
Nope. If I did, I can't remember.
The point behind it is that while it's so easy to... While the spotlight of the press, especially, always shines on stars, on celebrities and on the most successful companies, for example, even with bloggers. I mean, I've been part of that myself. I mean, Newsweek did a feature on alpha bloggers, and I was featured in that as an alpha blogger, which I said to them is sort of like being an alpha paramecium or an alpha algae. You know, we're all single-celled animals here, and try to single one out is kind of silly. It's more about the petri dish than about any one spore, as it were. But, you know, the point that Chris made was that most of the action is in the long tail of the curve. It's out. Technorati, David Sifri at Technorati has some interesting statistics on this, that most of the linking between blogs, for example, all happens, the great bulk of it happens among blogs that have, you know, less than 50 or 100 inbound links, or even less than 10 or 15 inbound links that they can find. And any one of those guys, because their stuff is syndicated, can start something. You know, you can start, if you have something cool to say or that you've found, you can start a wildfire real easy. It's pretty amazing. In the blog space. Well, I think the same is going to be true of music. And I think that what the record industry has to do is recognize that it has a huge advantage in the long tail. Now, one of the guys that was involved in the negotiations with the RIAA back before the ruling came down, I guess it was in 2001, told me that he sat across the table from this RIAA guy and said, hey, look, you know, we're on our stations, we're selling your records. You know, we want to help. We have enormous libraries that of music we play, much more than your standard all hit radio stations. We can move an awful lot of your library. And you know, a lot of those songs that are those albums that are sitting in the record stores that are not moving, we can move for you. And the guy looked him in the eye and said, we don't care. We are in the blockbuster business. We are in the, you know, our economic structure is all built around making a few great big stars and pushing them out through the, you know, through the billboards and through all kinds of vertical you know, vertically integrated promotional systems that run out through the, you know, the stadiums and the local radio stations and the rest of it. And you know, they're in the business of making a Britney Spears. They're not in the business of making you know, lots of little hits. Well, the problem with that is that the economics are really screwed up, and they always have been screwed up. They've been based on woeful inefficiencies. And what the internet all of a sudden presents is, well, wait a minute, maybe we can move a lot of that stuff. Maybe we can be in the business of producing lots and lots of successful artists. And I think they're going to revisit that. I think inevitably they're going to revisit that. I think a lot of the artists that are sitting on tape and never got transferred to CD, for example. I mean, I can think of there are Judy Collins records. There are Doug... what's his name? I can't think of his name. Oh, it's Dan Hicks and his Hot Licks. I was looking for that one of those the other day. I have it on vinyl. It never made it. Some of his records never made it to CD. Well, a lot of those could make it, you know, skip the CDs. Just go ahead and produce them in pure data form and sell them on the web. Promote them through podcasts. Allow them to be easily promoted through podcasts. That's not going to be hard to do. All they have to do is embrace the phenomenon. And I think that at some point they're going to see a way of doing that.
Do you really think that the RIAA is going to embrace this, though, or do you think they're going to attack? I see it the other way. I think that eventually they're going to realize it's cutting into their pocketbook and they're going to start suing people. I don't think they care might. Whether it's a success or not. They, you know, they just want their money.
I think there's a difference here. I think there's a difference in kind between a podcaster who's out there in the public space, right, and not very anonymous, okay, not using, you know, some cryptic name on Morpheus or Kaza, right, as a file sharer, but rather somebody who cares about music and who is a connoisseur, and who wants to promote this stuff, and who's out there saying, you know what, I can't play this, so I'm going to play something from, there's a site, I'm trying to remember it, there's a podcast that's that does nothing but covers,
Coverville.
Cover songs. Yeah, right. I'm going to play something from those guys. I mean, if I'm a record industry guy, I'm going to look at that particular site and say, wait a minute, you know, there is going to be, I mean, for, you know, suing people isn't working real well. You know, it's not, it's barely slowed down.
It only works for the lawyers.
You know, illegal. It only works for the lawyers, you know, and, you know, the, you know, on the one hand, these guys are going to work to, you know, expand the DMCA, and they are going to work to, you know, to make copyright difficult for everybody. That's not going to go away. But at the same, but that's the lawyer side of the thing. I think there is an entrepreneurial side of the business as well. It's been there since the beginning. Sooner or later, it's going to happen. Maybe it's going to happen with a record label like Magnatune, and you know, one of the big labels is going to buy Magnatune. Or buy one of the other record labels that's supplying the podcasters, but sooner or later it happens. It just has to. It has to because there are entrepreneurs that, you know, you can't sue your way to success. You know, and the lawsuits barely even protect your ass as you're busy failing, right? I mean, these, you know, it's really. I think in the long run, I mean, it's we're going to go through a phase where they are going to sue some people probably, but. You know, I think podcasters are very different than the kind of people they're trying to sue for sharing files. That kind of activity is very surreptitious. It, you know, the file sharers are generally trying to be anonymous in some way, whether it's passive or active. They're not out there trying to move the industry forward. I think people in podcasting are trying to do that, and I think it's going to make a difference. I think it's, you know, so I'm optimistic about that. But that's me. I'm an optimistic kind of guy. You know, so,
Doc, I think one of the problems is a lot of the mainstream media, I don't think they fully understand all the implications of podcasting or, you know, Myth TV, what it is exactly. Like, recently there was a couple of articles. One was in the New York Times where they were talking about Myth TV, and they equated file sharing with Myth TV, and it has absolutely, one doesn't have to do anything with the other. And these guys, you know, they're just mailing in their articles. They're not doing the research and finding out what exactly does this technology do.
Well, we're finding this out with blogging in a big way right now. That the mainstream media, for the most part, is especially on the journalism side, has an awful lot of empty shells. You know, they're people that don't do their homework, people that don't do the research. I mean, look at CBS. You know, CBS did a really lousy job with the story about Bush that got Dan Rather fired. That, you know, they were exposed as a relatively empty shell. You know, they were not what they as they appeared to be. I mean, what's happened with mainstream journalism is that it's turned into an accessory to the entertainment business. And so what's happened?
Yeah, what Doc said. I knew I liked you for some reason, Doc. You go, man.
Well, it's just an obvious thing, but nobody talks about it. I mean, not that many people talk about it. But in the long run, I think what happens is that you know, one supplements the other. I mean, the clueless, you know, Darwin will take care of the clueless guys. You know, the guys that are out there saying stupid stuff about podcasting and about blogging and you know, are going to be proven wrong, have their minds changed, or otherwise fade away. I mean, it's silly. I mean, and there are people whose minds are going to change. I mean, I think that William Sapphire, for example, had some kind things to say about blogging the other day. What's her name? Noonan. Peggy Noonan had possibly the best thing the mainstream media has ever written about blogging. The Greensboro, North Carolina, the town where I went to college, where much of this, civil rights struggle history happened because it was that backward in the old days, is the newspaper there, is it the leading edge of adopting and making use of local citizens that are blogging? It's inevitable that sooner or later radio stations and radio networks and, you know, and the music industry is going to start, you know, pieces of it are going to start doing the same thing. There are going to be Greensboros happening inside the blogosphere and the podosphere. You know, it's going to follow the same course as open source. I mean, you know, open source was, pretty small and lightly regarded, six, 8 years ago, and now it's standard. I mean, there isn't, I don't think there's a single company in the Fortune 500 right now that isn't adopting it one way or another. It's, you know, it's happening fast. I mean, it's a slight subject change, but I was talking to an IT consultant a couple weeks ago at the Desktop Summit in San Diego, who told me that, I mean, he's consulting one of the really big cable companies. I won't say who it is, out of deference to him. It may not make any difference, but I won't say it. And the whole what he did was laid out the strategy for replacing Windows desktop with Linux desktops. I mean, not just servers. Servers are done, right? And embedded's done. They're getting around to replacing the desktops. And the way they're doing it is first getting all the Windows users onto OpenOffice and other open source tools, and then Firefox, and they're getting them and Thunderbird and stuff like that, and using them on Windows, and then they're getting it, and then they're going to just replace the machines with Linux machines, or they're just going to shut them down and load Linux on them and move forward. That's the plan. That's where it's going.
Doc, your latest article in Linux Journal, you were talking about the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. And basically you're saying that a lot of these, manufacturers that make, home electronics, they don't want to admit that they're using Linux as the operating system that their product is built on. Why is
that? There are several reasons. One is that Linux is not a company. Linux is a project, right? And essentially, Linux is just building material. I mean, there may be companies selling Linux, but in a practical sense, it has no equivalent of an Apple or a Microsoft that are out there. You know, there's no organization that wants to put it, that has an OEM agreement that forces you to put a sticker on your laptop saying it's got Linux inside, right? That doesn't exist. So who are the people who know or care anything about Linux? Well, it's just the IT managers. I mean, even the CIO is pretty far from the top of the company, and they're not allowed to do the talking for the company. On top of that, a lot of these companies still have relationships with vendors, and they want to leverage those relationships, and they want to, and they want to play this guy off of that guy. They want to work Sun versus Novell versus Red Hat, even if they're busy using Debian and not telling anybody. And I know of at least, one case where that's happening. So they don't want me or anybody else blabbing out there saying that such and such a company, has standardized on Debian, because all of a sudden, the Red Hat salesman is going to come calling. Or the Novell salesman is going to come calling and saying, what gives? We've got a deal here, right? They want to be quiet about it. And on top of that, they've got company rules that say, the IT guys really are not company mouthpieces. Only the top executives and the PR people and the marketing organs are allowed to talk. And for that matter, the salespeople. And the salespeople, for the most part, don't want anybody saying anything that might screw up some sale somewhere. So generally, there are like lots and lots of reasons that the IT guys can't say shit. And SCO, in the last 2 years, has done a huge amount of damage in this respect as well, because they they've activated the lawyers. There are companies, and I'm going to leave them nameless too, because I want to keep the sources there if I can, that used to be really helpful to me, who I can no longer talk to, or I can no longer quote directly, or are afraid to talk to me, because their legal departments have told them, well, you know, SCO sued Daimler, Chrysler, and AutoZone, and we don't want to get sued because we're using this stuff that has some unclear legal definition. This is all going to get sorted out in a number of years. But in the meantime, people aren't talking about it. I mean, I was at a conference last fall where one of the keynoters, one of the main guys who was from one of the biggest banks in the country, gave a 45-minute talk about all the cool stuff that they're doing with Linux and with open source, but opened and closed it with like this agreement that everybody had to kind of nod along with, that nobody would talk about it, even though he was keynoting.
It's ridiculous.
And this is some sort of sop to his legal department, right? So there's a lot of fear out there, and something I wrote and was edited out of the magazine. It didn't make it past my editor in chief. But it's true. I said about SCO that it was like a flea floating down the river on his back with a hard on, yelling, "Raise the bridge." Okay, that's SCO. Okay, they don't matter. They're a little nothing company that exists only to litigate. You know, their entire business model is litigation.
Do you think they're that somebody else is behind them? I mean, the rumors go around.
Well, early on there was talk about Microsoft putting money into it. But I know people at Microsoft that have told me they deeply regret the fact that Microsoft put anything into there. I think Microsoft is strong enough. It doesn't need a SCO. I really don't think they need SCO. But that's me. I have no idea. I don't know what's keeping them afloat. I really don't. They have very little business that I know of, and
Microsoft.
Well, maybe I'll hear from them and say, you know, they're much bigger than that. And there's a reason they should we should raise the bridge. I don't know, but I think they've made my job a lot harder. They've made my job a lot harder, and have slowed things down a great deal. I mean, I think they were much more successful as a FUD agent than Microsoft ever has been. I'm not sure Microsoft even cares as much as it used to, honestly. I think there's too much reform going on that I know about at Microsoft. So,
but don't they have to reform, though, because, you know, their software doesn't work? So.
Well, it's not just that the software doesn't work. It's that they're and I think that's unfair. I mean, there are an awful lot of people who use the stuff. They put up with it. I mean, as the late and brilliant Jeff Raskin, who died a couple of weeks ago, said, imagine if when you were tying your shoes the usual way, they exploded, you know, every other Thursday. That's sort of what we put up with Windows, right? And it's
exactly,
like that.
Exactly, yeah.
But people are used to that. It's sort of like in the 20s and 30s, they were used to hand cranking their automobiles and pissing on spark plugs to make them work and carrying boxes of tools in the trunk. I mean, that's the way the automotive business was for a long time.
They took the spark plugs out first, right?
Right. You got to piss in the cylinders. Got to drink heavily first and then piss in the cylinders.
Nice arch shoot back.
Yeah, but what's I don't want to be unfair to Microsoft. I think in the Linux community and in the open source community, we give scant credit to the reasons for their success. And I think that it's important to pay attention to why people use them. And it's not only because they're a big evil company. It's because there's stuff you can only do on their platform. And some of it's good stuff. But in the long run, Microsoft cannot ignore the fact that their customers are migrating rapidly to open source. There are a number of companies. There's one, Versora, here in Santa Barbara, where I live, for example, that makes its living doing nothing but migration from Windows to Linux. There is no business in migrating from Linux to Windows. It doesn't exist. Okay, maybe Microsoft has a little business somewhere in that that they'd be glad to tell you about. But for the most part, it doesn't exist. Right? There is a huge movement going on right now from Windows to Linux, and especially on the server side, and eventually on the we're not very far from it right now on the desktop side. And really what's holding it up there is the laptops. There are no white box laptops to speak of, and it's not in Dell's or HP's interest, I believe, to push on that right now.
Right.
I think they like the margins they're getting with Windows. They have really strong relationships with Microsoft. Microsoft has a vested interest in making all of those laptops different and not commodities. The unfortunate thing is that in this day and age, for most of us, a personal computer is a laptop. It's not a desktop. And, but it's not far off. I mean, at some point, somebody's going to break rank on that, and it's going to happen. And at that point, it's going to look a lot more scary for Microsoft than it does now. And at some point, and I think when that happens, we're going to see Office on Linux. It's inevitable. I really think it's inevitable that we'll see Office on Linux, and we'll see Exchange on Linux, and we'll see, Access on Linux and some of these other tools.
I think that'd kill Microsoft right there if they ported Office over. That'd be it.
What? Why?
Because there would be no more reason to run Microsoft. That's the one holdout application that I hear everybody talk about.
There'd be no more reason to run Windows. But,
right.
But as of right now, I can tell you as somebody who uses both OpenOffice and Microsoft Office and makes a lot of presentations that it's a hell of a lot easier to prepare a presentation on PowerPoint than it is on OpenOffice. Now, I happen to think that OpenOffice has a real big opportunity to make it easier on OpenOffice, but right now they're still derivative.
Right.
And they're not as good. And people are used to PowerPoint, and people are used to Word, and people are used to Excel. And companies pay a lot of money for that, and I've been told by a number of companies that, they would gladly keep paying for Office licenses even as Windows licenses went away. It's a smaller business for Microsoft, and the leverage isn't the same.
But really, Doc, isn't that like a BS excuse, though? Because my company uses Office, too, and I can tell everybody from experience that Office 95 is not necessarily compatible or like Office 2000 or Office 97.
No, they've gone out of their way to change the file formats.
That's my whole point.
What I'm saying, though, is that on an, let's say the playing field is even.
Right.
Okay, and that everybody's running on Linux instead of on Windows. And Microsoft has Office. And OpenOffice is sitting out there. Microsoft has advantages there. They're already there. They've already done a lot of work. They've got the customers on top of that, and they know how to sell to those customers, right? There's
sure.
not, aside from Novell and Sun, there's not a sales organization selling into those, these giant enterprises. And it's a smaller business for Microsoft, and at some point they're not going to be making, the 70%, 80% gross profit margins. That's not sustainable in the long run. It just isn't. And what's happening is that the software industry is maturing. It's turning into a mature industry. I've often said in my own writing that it's going to be very much like the construction industry. And the construction industry is full of commodities, and commodities are good things. They're not dreaded. You can make 10, 20, 30% margins on commodities of one kind or another. Commodities make it possible to do other businesses. You make a lot more money because you've got something in the world rather than by selling that very thing. It's going to change. I mean, the business is going to grow up and change, and probably Microsoft is going to... I don't think they're going to fail. I think they're going to adapt, and it's a matter of time. It's probably 5 years out, but I think it will happen. They can't fight it. In the long run, they can't fight it. They can't fight their own customers.
Microsoft is really getting hurt now is in the developing third world. They can't compete with open source software. Okay?
Right. They can't.
Countries like Brazil and Mexico and Thailand, those people can't pay the money to have Windows running on their machines.
Right. But here's another way of looking at it. And this is I'm not sure whether this is to Microsoft's advantage or not, but in the same way as Microsoft can't compete with open source can't compete with free Microsoft, and that's what we're competing against right now. There are a lot of open source Linux-based desktops, for example, that are being sold in China and immediately get pirated Windows put on them and pirated everything else. You go to Bulgaria, you go to countries like this, and there's a huge business in black market Windows products. And an awful lot of stuff runs only on Windows. And the people, there's a whole economy around that.
Sure.
Now, that may not be to Microsoft's advantage in the sense that they want to sell into those marketplaces, but it is to Microsoft's advantage in the sense that the standard is there. And that's a very hard standard for open source to compete with. It's succeeding in places, but again, it doesn't compete as a company. It competes as something else. And, I think in the long run there's going to be some kind of a common ecosystem in which whatever's left of Microsoft competes as yet another big company.
Mm-hmm.
In a world that's absolutely filled with commodity open source products. And they can compete. I mean, an interesting thing is that I mean, Apple shows the way. I mean, they're at the bottom level. They're running on open source stuff, and they cherry pick open source standards here and there. They even create some like FireWire. They cherry pick and push some like they did with USB and with Wi-Fi. But they're still in a very proprietary business, and they sell at large margins. Not the kind of margins Microsoft does, but substantial margins. And there's that's a way to compete. It's in some ways annoying to me because I'd like Apple to be more open than it is, and I'd like to see other companies compete better with Apple than they do. I mean, it's astonishing to me that nobody knows how to make an easy-to-use MP3 player other than Apple, but there it is. It's not there yet. I've played with the iRiver, and it's baffling to me. Maybe it's certainly better than the Creative Jukebox was. That was the very first device that I bought, which is has the most opaque UI that's ever been put on anything, I think. it's that bad. But I want to get an iRiver. I'd really like to get the. I like the fact that you can record FM on them. I like the fact that you record in a lot of different formats, that they'll read a lot of different formats. I think iRiver's trying to do a lot of things right. It's just that their UI is a bit difficult. Well, of course, Apple doesn't make it easier.
I'll tell you what, Doc, and I know for the benefit of our listeners, Doc, of course, is a regular listener of our show and already knows that we did a review of iRiver last week. And based on my review of my iRiver that I picked up because I needed something to record on, like you said. And by the way, if you're planning on like doing any podcasting and you want to be able to do it mobily, the iRiver is the thing to have. Works really, really well. But anyway, I told the rest of the guys here about it last week, and they all went out and got one. So we have quite a crew of iRivers hanging out here right now.
I would like one. I had an iPod. I didn't buy it. I actually won it. And I actually didn't win it. I was sitting next to Brian Bellendorf, who started. He probably wouldn't want me to say this, but he won it. But he already had something, and so he said, "Hey, you want this?" And so I got it. But then I went and forgot it on an airplane. It was one of the minis. I can't believe that I did that, but I did. But I really want to replace it with an iRiver. I really love it. That's the plan.
They're really cool. I'd highly
advocate you get one. You gotta ask, so what iRiver are you talking about? Because there's the flash based iRiver,
right,
and there's
the
hard drive based iRiver.
The hard drive one,
the hard drive one that I the cool one that I saw at CES that they weren't quite out with yet. That's the one. It was.
This
it
is
was
the like one with the LCD screen on it that does
it's an
pictures
screen,
and all kinds of stuff.
It's got 60. It's got 60 gigs. I think the body's black.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, it was in a darkened room with babes, so it was kind of hard to tell, you know. But
because
this is CES, right? You know, so they, you know, they stocked the room with sales agents, as it were, you know.
booth babes,
you know, and they had amazing booth babes there. And but then they were in like this darkened room in the back of one of the floors where, you know, you went in to look at the. You know, they were showing off the products like they were the Hope Diamond on a little on their own little pedestal, you know, with a lanyard attached to it that would keep you from stealing it, and of course with dead batteries, so I really couldn't play with most of them. But they looked really cool. I mean, the feature list on the 60 gigabyte one, you know, had no shortcomings as far as I could tell. You know, but one of the other ones that I played with, it was like, how do you do this now? And how many menus do I have to go down through to find what I want to do with this? And it's a little bit hard, but, the Arcos looked interesting to me, though. The Arcos has looked really cool. They're like this whole multimedia TV thing. They're Linux-based. Have you seen those? ARCHOS?
I haven't even heard of them yet, but I will check
you
them
know,
out.
You know, very cool. People have been talking about those on the list.
They're really cool. Look at Arcos.com. Yeah, they're definitely neat. They were showing me one of their next ones. Yeah, there we are.
Oh, it's not
yeah,
a flash-based site. Good.
Yeah, isn't that nice?
Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, the one they show on that little pedestal, it's similar to that. I think is the one that I saw. But I mean, it's you can, you know, it does. I think it's a 640x480, and it you know refreshes at actual TV frame rates and movie frame rates and looks great and runs on Linux and, you know, does music and everything else and recognizes many formats and has decent sound and good battery life, supposedly. I haven't tested it yet. I'd love to test it.
Is that the one that was in they did a review of that in the first issue of Tux Magazine? Was that
That's
the device?
Possible. That could be. I don't know. I should know, I guess.
That looks nice. You if know, now, if our listeners would only send us one.
Yeah, we need one to review. Perhaps
exactly.
You know, perhaps you could put a good word in for us, right, Doc?
Right. Okay.
Send it to the tech show.
I'll have
guys.
To get back in touch with them. I'm looking at this. You reminded me of the massive size of the pile of business cards that I have here, which is scary, and that a lot of which I collected at CES. You know, the interesting thing at CES was that there. In the main hall, there was enormous fear of Apple. I mean, Apple was seen as like the new Microsoft. And Microsoft was seen as like the good guy because, like in the case of Creative, you know, which used to be an Apple partner before Apple decided to compete with them with the iPod, Microsoft's, you know, DRM silo works with a variety of different kinds of MP3 players and of other things like that. It was really weird, and I mean, Apple was just sort of like this phantom menace that nobody that wasn't there. You know, they didn't have a booth at the show, but there were lots and lots of iPod accessories and lots of cars with jacks where you could plug in your iPod and stuff like that. And you know, but to me, the most interesting stuff was the in those halls were the Linux-based set-top boxes and all-purpose household multimedia player systems. They were very cool, in part because they felt so liberated from needing to be in anybody's silo. There's one called Sage. There's another one called Interact TV that I saw a year ago and then saw again on this show. You know, and they're doing cool stuff. I mean, there are certain places like around DVDs where they have to do some of the regional DRM-y kind of stuff, but for the most part, you know, they're working with development communities and you know, and the rest of it.
Are you familiar with MIT TV, Doc?
MIT TV?
Yeah. It does all the same thing, like the Replay TV and the TiVo, and there's a whole bunch of other functionality besides.
How's it spelled?
MYTH TV. MIT TV. MITTV.org.
Hmm. It is. Oh yeah.
It's a great application.
Oh yeah. Okay. Oh yeah. No. No. Yeah. Yeah. I have. I'm not familiar with it, but I have heard about it.
It does everything that all these, you know, these manufacturer HP and whoever, you know, these set-top boxes, you know, plus then some.
Mm-hmm.
I went and I built a dedicated Myth box recently in January, and
that's cool.
It's great. I love it.
They're at the 0.17 release. And it's working for you?
It's awesome. It's great.
Really?
It could be a little bit of a bear to install, but there's a couple of different ways to install it that are a little easier. You know, there's a couple of different how-tos. Like, Not Myth is like a distro that will do the install for you. And there's also another one. There's a how-to by Jared Wilson where he does a Fedora-free-based install. And it does everything that Sage TV or those other ones doing. It's completely open source. If you get a chance, check it out a little more.
I will. Yeah, yeah. It would. Yeah, I just got lost in reading it a little bit. So, another cool thing.
Yeah. Hey, Doc. See. We're gonna run out of time here pretty shortly.
Yeah, I am too. I've got an 8-year-old boy here who's.
Let me just ask you a couple of really, really quick questions that everybody is dying to know. Since you are
boxes
you know,
of briefs,
that's right. Boxes of briefs. Since you are, since you're Doc Searles, and everybody knows who you are, we want to know.
Really.
Everybody,
there are members of my family who don't know who I am.
Everybody,
so it's okay.
We want to know what kind of computer you run, what operating system you run on it.
Okay, you know, well, the
Fire Emacs, that kind of thing.
The main box, not the one I'm talking on now, is a ThinkPad T40 from Emperor Linux, which is, they do these custom Linux laptops.
Yeah.
It was running, I got it a year ago, it started out running Fedora Core, then we, because suspend and resume and sleeping and all that kind of thing was problematic, it went to our tech headquarters in Costa Rica. When you go to Linux Journal's site, you're looking actually at a Costa Rican server, which I think is kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
Same with IT Garage, which is this other site that I run. And where we awaited the release of SUSE 9, which is based on the 2.6 kernel. And I had that, and I had a lot of little problems with it and so forth, and then, as we all do with everything, and then at this latest Linux world, I really liked what Novell was doing with their desktop, which is a SUSE-based desktop, and they're kind of biased toward GNOME, which I hadn't used much before. I've been mostly using KDE, but I'm using it with GNOME now, and it's really cool. I like... You know, I like the red carpet package management, which is kind of a nice UI on top of their RPMs. So that's sort of, I'm trying to move as much of my life as I can to that box right now. So that's sort of where I'm focused. My only complaint about it actually is just the fan. The fan on this particular box is noisy, and it exacerbates my tinnitus, which. You know, the ringing in my ears. I don't know what it is about computer fans that do that, but there's something about it, about that one in particular. The other one is the one I'm talking over now, which is the an Apple, a 17-inch Apple G4 PowerBook with it's the original one. It's the one gigahertz one, and that has a second screen attached to it that moves around. I've got a couple of servers in the next room, which are sometimes on and sometimes off, depending on what we're trying to do. One of them runs Red Hat. The other one runs one of the oldest forms of Debian ever still in use. But it does get on the net, and I use that from time to time to push out articles that I've been doing, stuff like that. That's actually been kind of mothballed, but that... I kind of keep it around for nostalgic purposes because it's been, you know, a part of my Linux Journal life since 1998. I think it's a Pentium 3 something or other. Its name is Happy. So right now it's just sitting there. So that's, you know, that's basically it. So what are you guys running out there? I mean, I
Slackware.
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 Ubuntu.
Debian.
Ubuntu.
Fedora 3 on my MythBox.
Yeah. We, you know, it, Linux Journal is mostly a, you know, we kind of standardized on SUSE a couple years ago, about a year and a half ago, just for support reasons. You know, but there's, we were mostly Debian for a long time before that. You know, I'm not, you know, I'm like the last guy you'd want to model yourself on, because I'm, you know, my joke about my technical chops is that the only code I know is Morse. So that's how
Jurassic
that's
code.
How far Jurassic, right? And it's yeah, I was a ham radio operator 1,000 years ago, and I haven't forgotten that crap. But you know, I got started late on this stuff, so I'm really slow. I'm slow on the uptake. I got to learn crap over and over again. It's hard. It's hard. I'm a good test bed for stuff that might not work, because I'll confirm that that's true in a lot of cases. Even if it doesn't deserve not to work, I'll make sure it won't. You know, I just spent like a lot of the last 2 days troubleshooting, you know, the Wi-Fi in the house. There's we have two different cable modems. Cox Cable, which is our local cable provider, has their business service, which is what we're talking over right now. It's like 1.5 megs down and 250K up, I think. Why it's asymmetrical, I have no idea. But I can, they don't block port 80, and they don't play other tricks like that, and they give you IP addresses. So it's actually useful if you're going to run a server. And if you don't want to run into little weird, you know, problems where they've throttled back the service. Meanwhile, so that's what I'm talking about now. But my wife and other parts of the house run on the household service, which has a different Wi-Fi base station, and which has port 25 blocked and has port 80 blocked. And, you know, because I might be a spammer, right? Who, you never know. You know, it's annoying. But anyway, so, you know, and you know, when it was all over, I finally found, you know, figured out there were just like a couple stupid things that were user errors on my part that I hadn't done, you know, and it just, you know, that's life, right? And I'm doing that instead of learning more Linux, right? So that's my life. That's my technical life. There's other things going on besides that, but that's the technical side.
All right, Doc. So, well, you know that you're more than welcome to. I know that you got to miss being on the Linux Show Weekly. So I would just
it
love
is
to
weird. My Tuesdays aren't the same.
Yeah, I would love to extend.
My family's happy about it, but yeah. Okay. Well, I'd be glad to.
I extend the opportunity for you to come on. You know, any Wednesday you would like to talk, you're more than welcome to.
Well, thanks.
Because we run it every Wednesday at the same time.
same time, same device.
That's right.
Well, cool, guys. It's been great talking to you.
Yeah, we really appreciate it, Doc. You know, I just want to say one more thing. I got to say, I've listened to you on the Linux Show and on the
Gilmore Gang.
And I never really looked at your picture in Linux Journal. And just for you saying you were 57 today, you sound a lot younger. You sound really... I pictured you as, like, some kid, like, right out of high school or something with a baseball cap on.
I sound younger today. You know, today. You know, fortunately, voices don't age as fast as the rest of us do, the rest of our bodies do. But this morning, I was at my kid's school, and so somebody, one of the other parents said to me, "Do you compost?" And I said, "No, I'm just aging normally." That's okay.
Not dead.
My kid just passed me a note saying that the hot tub has reached 105 degrees and is now ready. So.
Well, you go enjoy your hot tub.
All right, Doc. We're sorry to keep you so long, but boy, we really had a lot of fun talking to you.
Me too, guys.
Thanks a lot. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care.
Okay. Take care.
Have a good one.
Good night. All right, everybody, and that was
Mike Check.
Doc Searles.
Doc, nice guy.
Awesome Fantastic. Guy. Glad to have him on the show. Boy, I hope he avails himself of our offer to come back on a regular basis. That would be really, really cool. And just because we have 4 minutes left, right? I just got permission in email to play for you some specific music that everyone was really dying to play for you from a band called Enter the Haggis. And their website, you can reach them. I just put that, earlier on the IRC chat. Their website is enterthehaggis.com. And...
Are they Scottish?
I would like to... Yeah, they're pretty good. I would like to play for you Enter the Haggis' song called Another Round, and we'll probably just wrap it right up after this. So,
you know what? I just want to add one more thing.
Dan's going to get his You can't stand it, man.
It's compiles done.
Not yet. one of the requests that we have had in the past is to do kind of like a how-to on a radio show.
Uh-huh.
And I've been putting a little how-to together. I only had the first page.
Yeah, man. I noticed.
You mean how we do this? This
not
here?
Just this, but just, you know, basically how to do a Linux web radio show based upon our experience here, other stuff, just software and stuff. So, you know, I've been putting something together. And if anybody wants to,
you
know,
five or six geeky guys and like 25 computers, and you just wire them all together, man.
Just thought I'd throw that out there.
A little more detail than that.
So definitely give me feedback, comments as I get more of it up there. I started on Monday and haven't touched it.
Where's the link, man?
It's just right off the linuxlink.net.
Okay, I'll have to check it out now because
it's only one page so far.
I can add my own personal level of expertise in there.
Take that personal level of expertise.
Yeah.
What is Haggis?
All right. Haggis.
Good question.
Haggis is a...
You don't want to know.
Haggis is the Scottish version of... what's that crap Scrabble. They have here? Scrapple. Yeah. Ugh.
Nasty.
Yeah, but their music is great.
Scrapple actually tastes good.
So anyway, listen, guys.
Not really, but...
We're going to leave you with this because we're running out of time. So this is Enter the Haggis, another round. We'll catch you next week on the Linux Link Tech Show. Good night.
Have a good one.
Good night.
Good night.
I suppose we're going to have not mute the volume, right? Probably. That would be a good thing. Don't mute the volume. There we go. All right. Good night, everybody. Linux Link Tech Show.